A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a whole thing this week about the Manhattan Project, and I'll admit my first reaction was, here we go, another Oppenheimer think piece. But he's asking something sharper than that. The movie gave us the tortured genius in a room, the moral crisis, the security hearing. Daniel's point is that the actual project employed almost 130,000 people at its peak, and almost none of them were in that room. He wants to know how the project achieved that scale, how to mass that headcount and budget, and what the story looks like when you stop telling it through the physicists and start telling it through the machinery that actually built the thing.
And the machinery is the right word. The Manhattan Project was run by the Army Corps of Engineers. That single fact does more work than any 10 scenes of Oppenheimer staring at a chalkboard. The Corps didn't think in terms of scientific breakthroughs. They thought in terms of construction schedules, procurement contracts, and how many miles of railroad track you need to move 50,000 workers into the middle of nowhere.
Which is the version of the story that gets about 4 minutes of screen time in a 3-hour film.
Less, honestly. And I like the movie, I should say that up front. But it's a character study, not a history of the project. Daniel's right that the wider mission has been undertold. So let's put some numbers on what the movie didn't show.
Do it.
At its peak, the Manhattan Project employed nearly 130,000 people across three main sites and dozens of smaller ones. The budget was about $2.2 billion, which people like to convert to roughly $30 billion today, though that conversion undersells it because wartime labor and materials were cheap. The big three were Oak Ridge in Tennessee, Hanford in Washington, and Los Alamos in New Mexico. Los Alamos is the one everyone knows because that's where the scientists were. It was the smallest of the three by an enormous margin.
How enormous?
Hanford alone employed about 50,000 people at its peak. Oak Ridge grew to roughly 75,000 residents, making it the fifth largest city in Tennessee at the time, a city that didn't exist on any map. Los Alamos had maybe a few thousand people, mostly scientists, their families, and support staff. So the movie's entire frame, the geniuses on the mesa, is maybe 3 or 4% of the workforce.
So the film isn't just leaving out some workers, it's leaving out the project, and calling the remainder by the project's name.
And the remainder wasn't a garnish, it was the thing. The physics was largely solved on paper by 1942. The problem was never really whether a chain reaction was possible. The problem was that you needed enriched uranium or plutonium in quantities that no industrial process on Earth could produce at the time. That's a chemistry and metallurgy problem. It's a manufacturing problem. It's a logistics problem.
So the bottleneck wasn't the equation. It was the factory.
Right. And the factories were unlike anything that had been built. Oak Ridge had three separate enrichment plants running three different methods simultaneously because nobody knew which one would work. The K-25 gaseous diffusion plant was the largest building in the world when it went up, half a mile long, housing miles of piping and thousands of diffusion barriers. Building K-25 alone took more construction workers than the entire scientific staff of the project.
Half a mile of roof over a process that might not even work.
And they built all three methods anyway, because the cost of being wrong was losing the war. That's the thing about the scale. It wasn't optional. The Army didn't say, let's try the cheap one first. They said, we don't know which of these will work, so we'll build all of them, concurrently, at full industrial scale, in secret.
That's a decision that only makes sense if you have no budget constraint at all.
Which they effectively didn't. The $2.2 billion was a rounding error compared to the cost of the war overall. The B-29 program cost more than the Manhattan Project. The Liberty Ship program cost more. So the project had money, but money doesn't build a secret city in 18 months. Coordination does.
So how did they actually do it? Walk me through the mechanics.
The Corps of Engineers treated it as a military construction project, which is exactly what it was. They had a standard housing design, prefabricated, that could be assembled in a day. they built Oak Ridge's first 1,000 houses in something like 100 days. They recruited workers with vague promises of war work, good pay, and no information about where they were going or what they'd be doing. The railroad spur went in first because everything else depended on getting materials and people in. Then the housing, then the plants, then the support infrastructure, schools, cafeterias, laundries, a hospital. A city of 75,000 people that officially didn't exist.
And most of those people didn't know what they were building.
Almost none of them did. Compartmentalization meant you knew your task and nothing else. The woman running a Calitron panel at Oak Ridge knew she was turning dials to keep a needle centered. She didn't know she was separating uranium isotopes. She'd been told that if the needle drifted, the war effort suffered. That was the entire job description.
Which is both brilliant and horrifying as a management strategy.
It's the only way to keep a secret at that scale. You can't brief 130,000 people, so you brief maybe a few hundred, and everyone else operates on need to know, which for most of them was nothing. The workers at Hanford who loaded graphite blocks into the B reactor didn't know they were building the world's first full-scale nuclear reactor. They knew they were stacking very heavy black bricks to very precise tolerances.
The B reactor. That's the one they designed and built in about 18 months, right?
Yeah. And that's worth sitting with. The world's first full-scale nuclear reactor, designed and constructed in a year and a half by people who mostly didn't know what a nuclear reactor was. The graphite blocks alone required thousands of workers to fabricate and machine and stack, and the tolerances were brutal because any gap could let neutrons escape. They built it in a desert in Washington State, powered it up, and it worked. That's not a physics achievement. That's a manufacturing achievement.
It's the difference between writing a recipe and running a kitchen that serves 100,000 meals a day. The recipe matters, but the kitchen is the thing.
And the kitchen had a workforce pyramid. At the top, a few thousand scientists and engineers. Below them, tens of thousands of technicians, machinists, operators. At the base, construction workers, janitors, cafeteria staff, security guards. The base is where the project actually lived. The base is also where the project's ugliest contradictions lived.
The segregation.
Oak Ridge was in Tennessee in 1943. Jim Crow didn't pause for the war effort. Black workers made up a significant portion of the labor force, particularly in construction and unskilled roles, and they were housed in separate quarters with separate facilities, separate everything. They did some of the most dangerous work, the construction, the cleanup, the jobs that put bodies closest to hazardous materials. The National Park Service documentation on this is pretty stark. The project was fighting fascism abroad while maintaining a racial caste system at home, and nobody at the time seemed to find that worth remarking on. And it's not incidental to the scale story. It's part of how the scale was achieved. Cheap labor, segregated labor, labor you could assign to the worst jobs without anyone asking questions. The project ran on that the same way it ran on electricity.
So the machinery of scale had a human cost, and that's where the story gets uncomfortable.
The human cost is the part the movie skips entirely, and it's the part Daniel's question really opens up. Because the workers at Hanford and Oak Ridge were exposed to radiation and toxic chemicals without knowledge or consent. They couldn't consent because they didn't know what they were working with. The Seattle Times did a long investigation into this. Hanford workers, many of them women, many of them minorities, suffered health effects that were covered up for decades. Cancer clusters, thyroid disease, chronic illness. The government knew the risks and didn't tell the people taking them.
And the workers couldn't even ask the right questions because they didn't know enough to ask.
That's the structural feature of a compartmentalized megaproject. The moral weight falls on the few who know. The physical weight falls on the many who don't. Oppenheimer got a moral crisis. The woman running the Calitron got a paycheck and, in some cases, a health condition that took 40 years to be acknowledged.
That's the line that undoes the movie's frame for me. The movie treats the moral crisis as the cost of the project. But the moral crisis was a luxury. It was available only to the people who knew enough to have one.
And most of the 130,000 didn't. They got the physical cost without the ethical burden, which is, if you think about it, a pretty clean division of labor. The thinkers got the guilt. The workers got the cancer.
That's grim. And it's the actual story.
It's the actual story. And then there's the part that's still being paid. Hanford didn't shut down after the war. It became the center of Cold War plutonium production. The site now contains 56 million gallons of radioactive waste in underground tanks. Cleanup costs are estimated at over $100 billion, and completion is projected around 2060 or later. The project's $2.2 billion budget is a footnote. The true cost is an order of magnitude higher, and it's still accruing.
So the most expensive part of the Manhattan Project is the part that happened after it ended.
Which is true of a lot of megaprojects, but rarely this literally. The tanks at Hanford are leaking. Some of them have been leaking for decades. The groundwater contamination is a problem that will outlive everyone who worked on the original project and probably everyone listening to this episode.
And none of that's in the movie, because the movie ends with Oppenheimer's security clearance hearing. The story ends when the individual's story ends. But the project didn't end. The project is still running, in the form of a cleanup that will take another 40 years.
That's the narrative problem Daniel's pointing at. When we tell history through Oppenheimer's moral crisis, we inherit his frame. The scientist who builds and then regrets. It's a compelling frame. It's a tragic frame. But it's also a privileged frame. The 130,000 workers didn't get a moral crisis. They got a paycheck, or a pension, or a health condition, or a badge in a drawer. The movie's focus on individual conscience is itself a form of privilege. It says the story that matters is the one where someone knew enough to feel bad about it.
And the people who didn't know enough to feel bad about it are, by definition, not the protagonists.
Right, they're extras. They're the background of the story, but they were the foreground of the project. The bomb wasn't the product of a few minds. It was the product of an entire industrial system. The scientists provided the blueprint. The machine that executed it was the same machine that built Liberty ships and B-29s. The Manhattan Project was less a scientific breakthrough than an industrial one. The science was done. The industry had to be invented.
That's the sentence I want on a poster. The science was done. The industry had to be invented.
The industry was invented by people whose names we'll never know. The pipe fitters, the welders, the women on the Calutron panels, the men stacking graphite blocks. They built the thing. The physicists designed it. There's a difference.
What does that mean for how we should think about today's megaprojects? Because Daniel's question isn't just historical. It's about how we tell the story of anything world-changing.
The uncomfortable parallel is that we're still telling origin stories through individual genius. The AI story right now is told through a handful of names, the same way the bomb story is told through Oppenheimer and Fermi and Teller. But the actual work of building AI infrastructure, the data centers, the chip fabrication, the power grids, the cooling systems, that's being done by a workforce that's just as invisible as Hanford's pipe fitters. And they're working under the same kind of compartmentalization, often without knowing what the systems they're building will ultimately be used for.
The data center technician running fiber through a facility in Ohio doesn't know whether she's building the infrastructure for a medical breakthrough or a surveillance system. She just knows the cable has to be run.
When the history of this era gets written, it'll probably be written through the founders and the researchers. The technicians will be a footnote if they're mentioned at all. The movie version of this moment is already being scripted.
The lesson of the Manhattan Project isn't just about the bomb. It's about how we narrate scale. We keep telling the story of the few, when the story is actually about the many.
The many are deliberately erased. That's the part that still gets me. It's not just that workers were anonymous, it's that the system was designed to make them anonymous. Compartmentalization wasn't just about secrecy. It was about making sure the workforce couldn't tell a coherent story even to themselves.
The badge with no name.
No, no name, just a number. And the number didn't connect to anything a worker could access. The whole point was to make the workforce illegible.
My grandfather had one of those badges. He was a pipe fitter at Hanford in 1944. Recruited from a shipyard in Portland with a promise of war work, shipped to a site he wasn't allowed to name. Spent 14 months welding pipes in what he later learned was a plutonium production facility. He never talked about it, not because of secrecy, but because he didn't know what he'd built. He died in 1987. Leukemia. The family assumed it was the welding fumes.
The welding fumes. That's the assumption every family made, because it was the only explanation that didn't require knowing what the pipes were carrying.
The pension paperwork listed his employer as U.S. Engineer Depot, Hanford. When the family tried to file for veterans' benefits after he died, the VA had no record of him ever serving. The government had classified his employment so thoroughly that he didn't exist in any archive. He was a pipe fitter for 14 months at the most important industrial site in American history, and the official record says he was never there.
The erasure wasn't just cultural. It was bureaucratic.
It was both. The badge is a plain metal tag. Number 4471. No name, no site. I've been carrying it in my wallet for years.
130,000 people, and the system was built to make sure most of them left no trace. The movie's version of history feels natural because it's the version the record was designed to produce.
The record says a few hundred people built the bomb, because those are the people whose names were allowed to survive.
My grandfather didn't know what he was building. He knew the pipes had to be welded, and that the welds had to hold, and that if they didn't, the war effort suffered. That was the entire job description. Same as the women on the Calutron panels.
The compartmentalization worked. It kept the secret. But it also kept the workers from ever being able to claim what they'd done.
He didn't want to claim it. Near the end, when he was sick, my mother tried to ask him about Hanford. He said he'd been a welder. That was all. He didn't have a story to tell because the project had never given him one.
That's the thing about the badge. It's proof he was there, and proof that being there meant nothing.
It meant something to him. He kept it. He just didn't know what it was for.
The badge is the counter-argument to the movie. The movie says the story is about the man who knew. The badge says the story is about the man who didn't.
I don't know what the number means. Maybe it's a payroll code. Maybe it's a security designation. Maybe it's just the order they handed them out. Nobody ever explained it to him.
Now there's no one to ask.
The badge is all that's left. That and the leukemia.
The cleanup at Hanford is projected to cost over $100 billion. The workers paid a different kind of cost, and there's no cleanup for that.
We keep coming back to the same asymmetry. The people who knew got to write the history. The people who didn't got to live the consequences.
The consequences are still being lived. The Hanford site is still there. The tanks are still leaking. The workers' families are still filing claims, and the government is still processing them, or not processing them, depending on the decade.
My grandfather's claim was denied. No record of service, no record of employment, just a badge with a number.
The erasure was the point. If the workers didn't exist on paper, they couldn't ask for anything.
The movie's frame depends on that erasure. The story only works if Oppenheimer is the protagonist. If you put the pipe fitters in the foreground, the story changes completely. It's not about a man wrestling with his conscience. It's about a system that used 130,000 people and then forgot them.
The next history-altering technology won't be built by a few geniuses in a room either, and the people who build it may be just as invisible as Hanford's pipe fitters.
That's the open question Daniel's prompt leaves us with. If the real lesson of the Manhattan Project is about industrial scale and organizational capacity, what does that mean for how we should think about today's megaprojects? The AI infrastructure build-out, the fusion energy programs, the next generation of whatever it's that will change the world. They're all being built by workforces that are just as anonymous, just as compartmentalized, just as likely to be erased from the story.
The erasure isn't a bug. It's the design. We tell the story of the few because the many are hard to narrate. They don't have a single face. They don't have a moral crisis. They have a badge with a number.
The badge doesn't make a good movie, but it's the actual history.
There's a detail from the research that didn't fit anywhere. The K-25 plant at Oak Ridge, the half-mile-long building, had a roof that leaked so badly during construction that the workers called it the world's largest shower bath. They were building the most sophisticated industrial facility on Earth, and they were getting rained on indoors.
That's the whole story right there. The sophistication and the slog happening at the same time in the same building.
Where does that leave us? I keep thinking about the badge. Not Hilbert's grandfather specifically, but the idea of it. The physical proof that someone was there, attached to a system that was designed to make them forgettable.
The next time someone tells the story of how a world-changing technology was built, I want to know who the pipe fitters were. Not the geniuses. The pipe fitters. Because that's the version of the story that actually explains how the thing got built.
That's the version Daniel was asking for. Not the movie. The machinery.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird promise, where odd thoughts go, from sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.